The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hey, listener, are you happy with your current chicken wings? Do you wish you had something a little saucier? If you answered yes, then it might be time for you to break up with your old chicken wings and get a new honey. Lemon pepper wing from Popeyes. Share the wings with your friends so they can see it's time to move on, too. Head to Popeyes and get 6-piece honey lemon pepper wings for $5.99. At participating U.S. restaurants, price may vary.
Well, much as I might joke about that drive up I-80 to Sacramento, it was 100% worth it again because we got to witness one of the greatest performances in NBA playoff history in a Game 7, Steph Curry setting a Game 7 record by dropping 50 points on 38 shots in 38 minutes.
It was an incredible performance. It was an indelible performance. And I mean, yeah, to be the first person to score 50 in a Game 7. And not only that, but to break the record, Durant did his, which was in Game 7 against in that amazing series against the Bucks in 2021. That was in overtime. Durant played 53 minutes in that game. And Curry did that in a lot of different ways. And it was a lot of it. I thought this was really striking. I went to the shot charts a little bit while we were there live, but mostly came after the fact that the Golden State Warriors in total took 36 shots in the paint in this game. Stephen Curry took 14 of those. So that's more than a third of their shots. And when you consider the volume of offensive rebounds, don't worry, we'll get there. That's really striking. And to me, yes, Curry made 7 threes, was 7 of 18 from long range. It was that drive game, particularly in the third and fourth quarters, that was so essential.
Yeah, and that was something that was talked about after the game and was basically my biggest key to this game was how were the Warriors going to shoot the ball in the paint? Because we saw in Game 6, they got completely shut down in the paint. Sabonis had his best defensive game. Guys like Malik Monk are flying over for block shots. The Warriors were out of control on some of these drives. And Steve Kerr said before the game that they had some adjustments. One of those was obviously going back to Draymond in the starting lineup, which was overdue. But the other one, and I asked him to elucidate these a little bit more, he said he respectfully declined to do that because they're about to play the Lakers. But the biggest thing he talked about was the Warriors getting more spacing. And you saw on Steph's drives that he was able to get a shot off on most of those. And a couple of things showed up to me as far as what they did to try to help their spacing. One of those was they actually ran more through Kevon Looney as the handoff man and the screener to involve Sabonis, get him out top. But they weren't setting the screen where they typically do. They weren't setting it out near half court and, you know, maybe inviting a double team at that point, which then Looney would need to make the play going downhill. Instead, on a lot of these, they'd slow it down as they did for much of the game. And Looney would actually jog into the key and then jog back out to set the screen so that his man Sabonis wasn't quite in the same position that he might have been. And they also put Draymond Green actually in the strong side corner quite a bit, which was interesting because most teams don't necessarily want to help off the strong side corner. And Green, I think he hit 1-3 out of that scenario. But I think it was more just that guys are not programmed to do it. And maybe if you see it, I'm sure if there were a game 8, they would look at the film and be like, yeah, we're going to help off a Draymond Green in the strong side corner. But you've been taught through your entire NBA life not to do that. And so they're able to get a lot of drives that way. They got a ton on handoffs as well for Steph Curry. And that's usually not a huge synergy play type, but Curry on 8 plays that are characterized as handoffs, and the handoffs, the pick and rolls, the isolations, when they switch the pick and roll, like, is that a pick and roll? Is that an isolation? Like, all those can kind of run together. But Curry had 15 points on what were called 8 handoffs. And again, it was just mostly him at the top, quick pitch, get it back. And so they really did a much better job of fixing it so Steph Curry was able to get to the basket And then obviously the finishing was unbelievable as well.
And Nate, I brought up that I thought the second half was different. I hadn't looked all the way at this point. Curry took 4 shots in the paint in the first half and 10 in the second half, 9 in the restricted area, 1 in the upper paint. And Curry doing that generated looks for other people. And that was something that Seth Partno brought up during the game, was that one of the key stretches was, of course, the Warriors' ridiculous offensive rebounding in the third quarter. And part of that was good fortune, balls bouncing. Some of that was effort and hustle. And another part of it, and this was the point that Seth was making, is that the Kings' defense was a little out of sorts, a little discombobulated by those drives. And so guys weren't in the right positions, and that makes it harder to successfully rebound in those circumstances.
No, absolutely. And obviously, Kevon Looney was fantastic. We'll talk more about that third quarter. But I think we should finish up on Steph here. Dan pulled some great stats for us. What stuck out to those for you about where this kind of ranked historically as a performance?
Well, the first place that stuck out to me, it wasn't one that Dan pulled. It was one that you asked me to pull before, while the game was going on. This was the most shot attempts, field goal attempts that Stephen Curry has ever had in a game. And he didn't break that mark until kind of deep into the fourth quarter. It was the play-in game against Memphis a couple years ago. But 38 attempts, and then that ties in with something that Dan pulled, which was the players who took one or more field goal attempts per minute in a playoff game where they played 25 or more, and there really aren't that many of those. There are, by Dan's count, 7 ever, and it's worth running through those very briefly. Curry today, Russell Westbrook in an OKC Houston playoff game back in 2017, where he scored 51. MJ in 88 against the Cavs, 45 shots in 44 minutes. World Be Free had 27.
That's amazing that he's on this list.
It is.
Well deserved.
World Be Free, 77 as a Sixer, 27 shots in 26 minutes.
Well, here's the crazy thing about that. Like, Dr. J was on that team.
He was.
Still took 27 shots.
Wally Jones, 30 and 28. Rick Barry, 48 and 46 when the Warriors played Philly. And then Wilt Chamberlain on the Philadelphia Warriors, 48 shots in 48 minutes. And most of those players scored 50. The two that didn't only played, you know, in the 20s. But you get up a shot a minute, you're going to score some points.
Well, I think it's pretty remarkable. Some of these names, Westbrook, MJ, Wilt, Rick Barry. Those are the guys who are like volume scorers. Steph Curry has never quite had that mentality. And he came out with that mentality in this game. And it clearly was the Warriors' plan to kind of slow things down, get the ball in his hands. And Draymond said it after the game that they wanted to let him attack with a matchup he was comfortable with. And just, I mean, the way he attacked the paint, 22 points in the paint, that's the most he's ever had. The previous high was 18. He didn't get a ton of free throws in this game either. You know, it really was just relentless, relentless drives, particularly in that second half. And you felt like, even after the first half, like, man, these guys are exhausted as the first half is ending. And yet Curry, Kevon Looney leading the charge, but the overall Warriors team, Wiggins had a ton of energy too. Like, they had the energy. They ultimately had the conditioning edge in the type of game that they made this into, which was a half court game. And the other thing that I thought was pretty amazing here, Steph only had one turnover.
Yes.
And Kendra Andrews had this stat that Steph was responsible via assist or made field goal for 26 of the Warriors' 43 field goals. And he also created 53% of their 100 attempted field goals. So I tried to do a little back of the envelope math on that. The Warriors per synergy had 7 possessions that were basically just straight putbacks. So wipe those out then on the rest of their offensive rebounds per synergy, they pulled them out. So that was kind of a new possession, a new shot that needed to be created. So 93 total shots. If you think he played 38 minutes out of 48, approximately 73 of those first shots were created when he was in the game. And then he set up or shot 53 of those. So I'd guess, you know, Seth's total usage looks at what percentage of the plays does the guy either take a shot, set up a shot for a teammate by assist or potential assist, or turn it over, which was only one in this game. So his total usage was probably in like the 65-70% range, which is, again, way higher than he would be like in the regular regular season. He's in the mid-40s for that. So it was pretty incredible what a load he took on throughout the entire game. And, you know, particularly in that first half when Thompson is going 1 out of 10, Poole only had 5 points, for him to keep them in it and then push them through with this 50-point performance. It was unbelievable.
Oh, it is that time again. Wedding season. Indochino's custom suits will have you walking into a wedding looking like $1 million, feeling like $1 million, because their suits are custom made to fit you perfectly. You can get a tailored fit from the comfort of your home. You can set up your measurement profile on Indochino's website, choose customizations without even leaving the house. Indochino was the official outfitter of my wedding. I got a tux from them. All my groomsmen got custom fitted sport jackets, and I'd like to think we all look great. Order your custom suit now. Be ready for wedding season, whether it's at home or in person at a showroom near you, which I actually recommend. That's what I did. An Indochino style guide can walk you through all of the amazing customizations that they have. The lapels, the lining, single-breasted, double-breasted. You can feel the fabrics in person. That's definitely the best way to do it, in my opinion. But you can also do it from home as well. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com. Use that familiar Capspace code to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com. I-N-D-O-C-H-I-N-O. Indochino.com. Don't forget that Capspace code to let them know you came from us. Renters, you ever feel like you're stuck in this loop of rent payments, just watching your money vanish into thin air? It's time to turn that rent game around and start earning some serious rewards. That's where Built Rewards comes in. Built is breaking ground as the first rewards program that hooks you up with points on your rent. Even if you're still rocking the old school rent check vibes, Built Rewards has got your back. They'll mail the check for you. It's like having a personal rent paying assistant. Every month, pay your rent and watch the Built points roll in. Use points to jet off on a dream vacation. Put your points towards a flight or hotel stay with 500 plus airlines and 700,000 plus hotels and properties. You can also use your points towards a future rent payment or towards a future down payment on a home. Pay rent hassle-free through the Built Rewards app. Your rent game just got a major upgrade. Earn points by paying rent right now when you go to joinbuilt.com/capspace. That's joinbuilt, B-I-L-T, joinbuilt.com/capspace. Don't forget that /capspace URL.
Do you want to go to the third quarter, or do you want to talk about the first half ahead of that?
Well, I do. I think I have a little bit more on stuff here. I mean, I'll probably never run out, honestly. The thing that struck me just visually is for how that was so impressive. I mean, I talked about the conditioning, but again, the strength. Like, this is something that really became clear to me in last year's playoffs and even more so now, of just how strong Steph Curry is. And it isn't as much like the crazy dancing with the ball, the crazy step backs as early in his career, although he can still get those off pretty well. But it's just, even against a guy, you know, a 6'8", 225, like a Keegan Murray, he gets the shoulder past the guy and he just can't be bumped off his spot. And in today's game, like, once, you know, you can't put your forearm on him to try to ride him. And so then he's just going to turn the corner. And it's just the conditioning level to just drive time after time, not get tired physically, be strong enough to keep turning the corner. And then some of these finishes, it's become derriere for him, but I think he had maybe 4 of these in this game where he just picks up his dribble with one hand because the guy who's guarding him is right behind him, right? So even if you put 2 hands on the ball and kind of bring it to your stomach, you might get stripped from behind. So he just picks it up with one hand out in front of his body, continues to accelerate. And then we've seen guys do that one hand extension for like a layup, right? Like Steve Nash kind of started that. Gary Payton did it. You know, obviously Steph's one of the best at that. Pretty much every guard kind of has to have that in their game at this point. But he's pulling this shot with like a high arcing finger roll floater over a defender from like 10 feet away off the glass. Like, to have that kind of touch when you never even put your other hand on the ball, that's insane to be able to do that. And he's just become such a good finisher. Like, his drive game is almost more deadly now than his shooting game, even though obviously the shooting game is what sets it all up.
One of the other weird quirks of Stephen Curry's performance is that he actually missed both ends of a set of free throws. And it's the first time he's done that all year. And I mean, Curry, a notoriously great free throw throw shooter. Those were the only two he missed in the game, but he only took five, and he was spectacular. I think for me that the volume of, like you framed it in terms of total usage, the volume of opportunities versus the infrequency of mistakes was so unusual. And it's not like, you know, there are a lot of low turnover great players, you know, like Jimmy Butler or DeMar DeRozan. Like Curry is not that guy. And after the game, Draymond Green talked about it. Kevon Looney talked about it in particular, about how they, Looney in particular brought up the turnovers, but how that's a way that they can tell that Curry is, Draymond said, laser focused, is the lack of mistakes, the consistency of that approach. And, you know, I've covered his entire career, and it isn't always a hallmark of great Stephen Curry games, but it was a hallmark of this one.
The one other play I remember too, I mean, he didn't do much of the off-ball stuff in this game, and in fact, he only had four possessions characterized as spot-ups and four coming off of screens. And then 28 of his 38 shots were self-created, either pick and roll, ISO, or handoff. But the one that was so crazy at the end of the game is probably decided at this point, but 1.3 in the shot clock, he's the inbounder on a baseline out of bounds, and he gets the ball in to Draymond and gets out to the corner and gets the shot off all in 1.3 seconds. That was just, and obviously he used some of that time while the ball's in the air to Draymond to just start moving and get out there. But that was another play where he just like, and he got it off so fast, drained it from the right corner. I was just like, I've never seen anyone do that with that little time on the clock to like get out to a corner three as the baseline inbounder with 1.3 on the clock. That was absolutely remarkable. From the Kings standpoint, what did you make of Mike Brown's strategy on him? Because if you're giving up 38 shots and a 50 burger, like you have to question that some.
Especially because the Warriors' creation by non-Curry players has been pretty lackluster overall in the series.
And just shot making, even, not even creation necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, they had huge shot making at the end of game five. But other than that, it hasn't been spectacular. And I mean, there were some times Klay Thompson had a couple of flubs, like they had him bring the ball up and in the early part of the game didn't go super well. Draymond didn't really have the ball in his hands that much compared to his usual standard. But yeah, you put extra pressure on Curry, you may concede some open shots, but you're also you're taking the ball out of the most dangerous player's hands, and yeah, then he can get into some of the off-ball stuff. I think that's a part of it. And what was interesting, I don't have a diagnosis on this about why Sacramento's initial drive defense, so I'm talking about the player guarding Curry rather than the supplemental help, was worse. I think part of that is Curry was better, but...
Yeah, because there were times in Game 6 when he tried to get by guys and just couldn't do it. Like, he didn't seem to have his legs the way he did in this game. I'll say that.
Exactly. And so I thought that part of that was an interesting decision. Again, going back to Mike Brown, who has done a beautiful job in this series, but I thought they leaned too heavily on Terrence Davis, who is a talented offensive player, and the two threes that he hit in the first quarter were massive in terms of the Kings kind of staying in it and getting a little bit of life. But he can't guard Stephen Curry. And just as we talked about on Saturday about the lessons learned potentially by Monty Williams and Michael Malone in game one of that series, a key element to me of a game seven is to make, I always refer to this as like making the thing, where it's like the most important element of defending the Golden State Warriors is defending Stephen Curry. And sometimes that's personnel, sometimes that's scheme, most of the time it's both. And I thought from a personnel standpoint, this was worse than I expected from Sacramento.
There's so many moving parts here, and the Warriors did score a bunch of points. They put up 120 in the end. Obviously the offensive rebounding was a complete killer in the third, but worth noting too that with all the free throws that the Warriors missed in the third quarter, and Sacramento missed some too, but the Warriors were worse. Like, this should have been probably a blowout earlier than it was. Like, it should have been a 15-point game after three, and then obviously Sacramento couldn't score again. But the reason they went with Terrence Davis on Steph was because they felt like they needed the offense. They felt like they weren't guarding Davion Mitchell. He took 8 3-point attempts in game 5. They probably felt like that was more than they really wanted. And I mean, when the Kings looked bad in this series, it was because they couldn't score. Their half-court offense was not very good. And they also obviously leaned into Trey Lyles at center. They didn't go back to Alex Len there. And they had some pretty damn small lineups too, you know, with Davis, Monk, Fox. Like, those three guys on the floor together seemed like it was one of Mike Brown's preferred groupings. And so I think, you know, the personnel, should they have played Davion more? Like, maybe, like, especially when Steph, like, really got going, just to, like, try to give him a different look. I mean, I think that was the thing, is that they did mostly the same thing until there were 6 minutes left and they were down by 17, and then they tried to trap, and that, you know, they were going, like, full court traps at that point. So I think strategy, I don't know if personnel-wise they necessarily should have done something different, but in terms of just, particularly with how poorly the rest of the Warriors were playing. Obviously, yeah, I mean, you don't want to give Klay Thompson a wide open catch and shoot three, but when you've got Draymond and Looney on the floor together, to let Steph, like we never saw a switch double in this entire series. And even when it was late clock, right? So if switch double, usually that'll, you'll go to that when a perimeter player that probably can't handle stuff, like Keegan Murray, who got completely lit up by Steph in this series, and Steph was trying to seek him out every time. So we never saw that tactic tried once. Like, I think they were a little bit too one note, you know, or they could have trapped when they tried to go after Murray. Like, they just gave that switch up basically anytime Steph wanted it. And, you know, we didn't see that got them, you know, coming over into the strong side zone to deter the drive and force them to throw it to the weak side or something like that. Like, we just didn't see great loading of help, which I think you could, if Steph Curry was going to ISO like this, you know, they should have probably tried to say, okay, we're not going to let him just, like, put you in the mix over and over again, and then, like, get you, like, cross you over and then get a blow by, right? We just said, hey, you know what, we're going to try to force him right because he likes, so he can't shoot that step back, and we're going to try to, like, get someone loaded to him early and force him to get off the ball early. And the other thing too is, I mean, it was such a great tactic by the Warriors to do this. You talked about it, how Steph wasn't turning it over. Well, if you're just going to isolate all the time or just run one pick and roll in one action, and then Steph's just going to go, that really cuts down for your potential to turn it over. And that obviously is one of the big things that the Kings relied on in this series. So if you're forcing them to make more passes, hey, you're not necessarily getting stops anyway. So at least if you make them score by making a bunch of passes, like, maybe you'll get some turnovers as you're not getting stops. So that was, I think, you know, a little more Davion would have been good. Like, I liked the way they used Davion to just be like, okay, he's going to guard Jordan Poole and just completely shut off Jordan Poole, who can't do anything against him. But I thought they could have given him a little bit more and just tried some way to get the ball out of Steph's hands when it just obviously wasn't working at that point. But I think they had to juice the offense. So I think, personnel wise, I kind of understand why they did what they did, because they couldn't score. Like, that was their biggest problem.
I understand it. I just think at a certain point, you adapt to what's there. And like you, I don't want to, because this will come up more in the playoffs, the idea of using a defense first guard to shut off the water for a second unit is a great idea. It's also a natural reason why the Rick Carlisle, Energizer Bunny, multiple ball handler second units should be even more used than they are right now, is that it takes that away. But yeah, there were some really, actually, I might as well just hit this thread now because it's not as important in this way than it would have been. Steve Kerr was very aggressive, making sure in the early part of the game that Stephen Curry had enough rest. He would have played 40 minutes had the game been competitive enough that he needed to. But Kerr also had multiple stretches. I think it was 3 stretches in the first half where Curry and Draymond were out at the same time. And the first one of those I thought was really fascinating because the Warriors' offense was horrendous during that stretch. They only scored 3 points. It was a Moses Moody catch and shoot 3. It was about 3 minutes that they were both out, and then I believe it was a stoppage in play, a timeout or something like that, and they brought him back in. But Sacramento only scored 4 points because they missed a couple of threes. And so it was the idea of, like, it seemed to me like it was something where the Warriors got they were fortunate that they had a worse run of play, but they weren't affected too much on the scoreline. And having Davion out there for some of those minutes, it just ended. And I mean, you know, Curry ended up being plus 25 in a game the team won by 20, so they were negative 5 in the time he didn't play. But that could have been worse than negative 5. It was just a tactical wrinkle that I found not only interesting, but potentially now relevant for the next round.
Yeah, and they just kind of managed to get through it. Like, there was another one where Looney got an and one put back when they had one of their bad lineups on the floor as well. I guess we should... I kind of want to go through chronologically here with just some of the observations, because I think that really tells the story of this game, that if you look at the final score being 120 to 100, you kind of lose. I think, and both of us were in the arena, and I mean, to me, and you were the one who was favoring the Kings after game four, even, it didn't feel like the Warriors were going to win this basketball game at halftime. Would you agree with that? I mean, it's always possible with them because of the talent that they have, and they have Steph, and they can turn up their defense, but it felt like the Kings were significantly outplayed.
Particularly, I thought it was really important in the first half that the Kings got into the bonus with 6:30 remaining. Looney actually committed.
You think that's important, getting into the bonus early?
Vaguely.
I'm glad you've come around on that, yeah.
Looney, I mean, you know me, first three, second and fourth quarters. Looney commits an over-the-backbreaker with 6:30 left that produces free throws in the half. And Sacramento, yeah, I thought they had the run of play overall, not dramatically so, but I thought that they were the better team in that first half. And it was notable for Sacramento that their jump shooting was mostly there. They missed some early. Both teams were tight at the start. Also, actually, I just mentioned this in passing. Both teams missed a ton of free throws in this game seven. The Warriors were 19 of 30, so that's 11 misses. The Kings were 16 of 27. That's 11 misses as well. So both teams hovering in the like high 50s, low 60s in terms of free throw percentage was striking. But yeah, I thought that the Sabonis had some nice stretches defensively. Thought that he did well generally there. I want to talk about his offense, but we'll save that for later. De'Aaron Fox had 5 assists, and a couple of those were absolute beauties, including one to the opposite corner for Trey Lyles. I retweeted Mo Tequila at the video. Basically, it looked like the possession was dead in the water. Then somehow he sees Trey Lyles and gets the ball there, and Lyles hits that three. And so, yeah, I think Sacramento played pretty well in the first half, other than the jitters that both teams dealt with.
Are you waking up with a ton of back pain or shoulder pain or neck pain? The number one reason probably to consider is your mattress. Maybe it's time for a new mattress. And I highly recommend that you check out Helix Sleep, which you can do risk-free with their 100-night trial and a 10 to 15-year warranty, depending on the model. And they have 20 unique mattresses, the award-winning Lux, the Ultra Premium Elite Collections. They have Helix Plus, which is designed for big and tall sleepers. Helix Kids, endorsed by child sleep experts. You can take their 2-minute sleep quiz. That's what my wife and I did over 10 years ago now. We still have a number of Helix Sleep mattresses that we've gotten over the years, and we are extremely satisfied with them even now, 10 years later. You might be like, I kind of want to try it out beforehand. Going to the store is not really going to give you any information. You're going to be like, lay down, like, oh, do I take off my shoes? Maybe I should leave my shoes on, but then I got to have my feet hanging off the mattress because I can't leave my shoes on and sleep normally on this mattress. And then you're going to feel awkward laying there after about 30 seconds. Like, you can't determine anything in 30 seconds. So you're going to have to take it home, and you might as well just get it delivered straight to your door and utilize that 100-night trial. And there's never been a better time to use Helix, because they are offering 20% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners. You can go to helixsleep.com/capspace. Use the remote /capspace. We talk about all the time here on the program. That's helixsleep.com/capspace. This is their best offer yet. It won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now.
So I will be honest, I tend to pack on the pounds a little bit during the winter, holiday season, not getting outside as much. So in springtime, I try to eat healthier, and I'm really excited to try Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Each meal is fresh, never frozen, chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. This is going to be fantastic for me during the playoffs, when a lot of times I feel like I don't have time to eat healthy, and now I can choose from a number of their delicious but healthy options. I like to go keto. On occasion, they have that. They have vegan and veggie options as well. Here's what they've got for their keto weekly menu this week. Sun-dried tomato chicken with zucchini noodles. spicy poblano beef bowl with roasted broccoli, chicken piccata with cauliflower mash and broccoli, or if you want to go to their Chef's Choice weekly menu, jalapeno lime cheddar chicken, that sounds fantastic, Greek lemon chicken with roasted potatoes. This all sounds really, really good. Eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, cleaning up, heat and savor the good stuff. And they're also celebrating Earth Day all month long as well. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/dunked50, special code for this one. That's factormeals.com/dunked50 and use the code dunked50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code dunked50 at factormeals.com/dunked50. 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, obviously the Kings laid a big punch in Game 6 with some of their adjustments that we talked about, like Lyles at center, going to Moore, Terrence Davis, and the Warriors did have some things to attack what they're doing early. You know, they started off actually by shorting the pick and roll a couple of times, like Steph getting off the ball early, then finding Looney going right down the middle for a dunk because they put two on the ball and Steph. Kings kind of got wise to that after a couple times. Sabonis gave a much better effort getting back into the lane on after the initial putting two on the ball in pick and roll, and the Warriors kind of went away from that later on in the game. But Kerr also made sure to get Gary Payton II in on Malik Monk, and it certainly was a roller coaster experience with Gary Payton in this game. He had 4 blocked shots, 4 fouls. He actually ended up negative 13 in 16 minutes. But he did, anytime someone tried to go at him one-on-one, except maybe one Fox drive where he got called for a foul, like they just got completely, like either threw up something that was just useless or got blocked. He had like this one closeout in the corner that blocked a 3-pointer on a fast break by Herter, who's 6'8", by the way. But then also he made a bunch of mistakes, missed a layup as well. So it was, they definitely got something out of him, but it was a pretty wild ride from him. Moses Moody actually, again, was just in the rotation above guys like Kuminga. In fact, even above DiVincenzo, Payton kind of took his place, but it was important to get Payton in so that Monk wasn't going to just kill them the way he did. And I think all 3 of the Kings' victories in the series, Monk was fantastic, other than making comments that the Warriors were old and that they were going to run him out of the gym, which apparently made it into the Warriors' locker room. Go ahead. So,
It was a weird Klay Thompson game. Kerr praised Klay's defense, and I thought he did a solid job overall.
The second half, they put him on Monk when they were going with their best lineup, their starting lineup, and I thought he did do well, like kind of getting over screens in that matchup, which you would think he'd be a little too slow for that. He did do a good job.
Thompson, 4 of 19 from the field, 2 of 10 from 3, 2 of 9 from 2, took some aggressive 3s and 2s. That is a part of the kind of late series Klay thing, is that he takes a lot of shots of questionable providence and they sometimes go in like
they did. I mean, they desperately needed him because they played Poole absolutely as little as possible.
appropriately so. I mean, he had a couple of just doozies. His first shot was his worst shot, where he went at like a no-hoper drive, flailed trying to get the foul, and then it led to a 5-on-4 fast break that Sacramento scored on pretty easily. And so, but for Thompson, like a small play that I had in my notes, because what I do sometimes in games like this, my notes are plays that I wouldn't remember otherwise, was happened to be on our side of the floor. There was a late situation. Kings were up 3. And this was one of those indications that the Warriors were tired. And I can't remember who missed the shot. Somebody missed the shot and the ball was bouncing largely towards Klay, but sort of like a wide receiver who needs to move towards a softly thrown ball to ensure that they're the one who gets it. Klay just kind of waited for it, and I think it was Sabonis took a step in front of him, got it, and then the Kings got 2 points. And so it's like those sorts of small things, you know, if this game had gone differently in the second half, could have mattered. And Thompson's shot, you know, it wasn't all the way there. As Kerr noted and everything else, he brought value on the other end. And then the other part of that with Klay is, even if he's not making shots at the volume that he would like, that the Warriors would like, he provides so much spacing because the opponent is not going to help off it. And so that was a key part, you know, having him out there of the Warriors being successful driving. You don't have to put him in the strong side corner to make sure that the Kings guard him, because they will guard him wherever he is.
Yeah, having him on the backside of their pick and rolls does make the rotations really difficult for the other team. A couple other things that Kerr went to, he made sure that when it was Lyles at center for the Kings, that he had his rotation set up that Draymond Green would be out there at center opposite that, because that was really a lineup where with Looney trying to go against Lyles at center, they really got beat up in game six. So that was kind of the second mover advantage there. And I think, again, for Mike Brown, he probably should have had just like, and again, it's tough to say this in a game seven, but should have had like a couple more wrinkles in his pocket there for things to try rotationally that maybe might have thrown the Warriors off.
Well, because we saw throughout the series that the Warriors weren't great at in-game adjustments to those wrinkles. And so if they had had one or two, it could have theoretically not led to a response.
Late first quarter, the Kings really heated up, hit 4 of 5 threes in a row to close the quarter, although it was very similar to what took place in game five when they were 8 of 12 in the first quarter, and then everything just completely dried up for them after that. They finished 12 of 47, but the shot chart from three was much more in favor of the Warriors than it was in that game six, when, remember, the Kings were 9 of 18 corner threes in game six, and a lot of those obviously came off of transition, which the Warriors pretty much shut off, particularly in the second half in this one. And Sacramento only got up 7 corner threes in this one. Warriors actually got up 13 and probably could have actually made more of them. Like Wiggins and Clay missed a bunch of pretty good open ones. A few of those were Draymond, which, you know, they're probably okay with him taking. But I still felt at the end of the second, like the Warriors were just stalling at every second that they could to just like any fast break. They weren't really, like, or a defensive rebound, they weren't pushing it. They were crossing the timeline with 16.1 in the shot clock and just a ton of just like holding the ball, catching their breath. And I was like, man, like, these guys are exhausted. Like the Kings ran reasonably well in the first half. They're up to it at halftime. And you felt like, man, the Kings are going to have the energy here. They're going to run them out of the building. In the second, I felt like the Kings really should have tried to hit the offensive glass as hard as they could. And they got a Monk put back at the end of the third. They got a Herter, a couple of free throws. But their guards, they should have been sending like 4 guys to the offensive glass just because the Warriors were not going to push the ball under any circumstances. And instead, in that fateful third quarter, the Warriors got 15 offensive rebounds in one quarter, Danny.
Incredible. And they had significantly more offensive rebounds than the Kings had defensive rebounds during that quarter. Let me see, actually, I didn't try to pull this before we started recording. I think I can get this through advanced stats. So they had a 65.2 offensive rebound rate in the third quarter. That's pretty good.
Yeah, and I mean, it would have been even more of a blowout if the Warriors had hit more free throws. Like Thompson missed 2. I think they had 4 separate trips to the foul line in which they missed both. I think like Wiggins had 2, Looney had 1, and Clay had 1.
They also missed a ton of layups in that quarter as well.
Yeah. They start off, I thought that Mike Brown clearly didn't believe that Harrison Barnes was his best option at power forward, but he did start him in the third, and the Warriors really kind of jumped on him early third and got out to a 6-8 point lead that they really wouldn't, and part of that was the offensive rebounding, but part of it also was Fox having to start out in that matchup guarding Curry. They also didn't have Monk, who is really their second best offensive player in this series out there. He doesn't come in until there's 6 minutes left in the quarter, and now it is tough. I guess their best lineup was Fox, Monk, Davis, Murray, and Sabonis would have been like their best guys. I mean, that is a really small group, and, you know, maybe not surprising that you're going to struggle to rebound with a group like that. And Harrison Barnes has never been the greatest defensive rebounder either, and Murray is like only okay, and Sabonis had his hands full with Looney, and he ultimately got dominated. I think at one point Looney had 9 offensive rebounds, and Sabonis had 3 defensive rebounds in the game. And
that's up a bunch of fouls on the full Jared Allen / Mitchell Robinson.
Yeah, and now what the scheme was, obviously, was Sabonis will box out Looney, and then the other guys go get the rebound. And even when Sabonis had Looney boxed out, Looney was able to just in the right spot. I mean, he's talked about it before that he really makes a science of knowing where certain teammates are likely to miss. And I mean, as you see it, and he says beyond that, he doesn't want to talk about it, obviously, because that's information that he has that probably his opponents don't. But there's so many of these Looney rebounds where he'll be like 10 feet away from the basket, in theory, boxed out, and yet the ball will like bounce just over the guy boxing him out's head, right to him 10 feet from the basket. Like it happens often enough that you think there must be something to the idea of just like Looney knows that when these guys miss. Dennis Rodman used to do that too. Most of the great rebounders do, particularly guys who don't have a ton of size like Looney or Rodman, but do maybe have more mobility. So I think he just has it kind of dialed in of like, here's where the rebound is going to go with these guys, and just gets to that spot, even though it may not appear to be the most valuable real estate in the world.
You brought up Sabonis. I wanted to talk about something else. And the numbers weren't as striking as I wanted. I asked Dan to pull this, but it was still interesting. And I think it bears, because I had noticed something with this during the game. So Domantas Sabonis took 16 shots from the field. I think one of the ones that was in, maybe because Dan's list has 17, there might have been something that got in the play-by-play that got crossed up. Roughly half of those were around the basket. So, you know, that rate is fine. But what I noticed was the shots that were not around the basket seemed further out in game 7 than they were early in the series. And I think that there is something to that, because I brought up that there were 8 around the basket. Also, 12 feet, 16 feet, 17 feet, 19 feet, 19 feet, 26. And so those are all pretty deep out. And, you know, there's this idea over the years, it's come up in the context of a lot of different players, where taking a 10-footer, taking a 5-footer, and taking a 15-footer are very different things with very different success rates. And Sabonis, his shots that weren't around the basket being a little bit further out, I think that was a part. He was 0 for 3 in the upper paint. If you want to think about it this way, 2 for 7 on twos that were not at the basket, and 2 for 8 on overall field goal attempts that were not around the basket, that they were further out and they're harder to make. And the Warriors were conceding them, and he was taking them, and to an extent, like, you have to, you know, keeping them honest and all that stuff. But I thought that was really telling.
Yeah, his best offensive half of the series was 16 points, and got a lot of those obviously off of passes or running the floor. And it's not like that many of those were self-created. He hit a couple of those short rangers, or I should say more mid-rangers that you were talking about in the first. But I and Sabonis, obviously, like, if he could have been a more reliable one-on-one scoring option, I thought actually maybe one thing they could have explored was that the Warriors were willing to switch Andrew Wiggins onto him, and he got one nice post up on him for a foul. But I think that maybe, as particularly as much as they're struggling, they could have looked back to that. But the other thing, it really surprised me they didn't go to, and again, we don't know, like, maybe Fox had somewhat of a setback with his finger. I mean, it was such a weird injury where it's like he would have these times where he, like, oh man, that's a terrible turnover, like, or a terrible miss, like the finger must be bothering him. And, you know, maybe it's the kind of thing where he would just, like, oddly feel pain and, like, and just wouldn't be able to control it, or it just hit his hand in a certain spot and he would lose it or something. But I mean, De'Aaron Fox was awful in this game. I mean, he took 10 three-pointers, made 3 of them. That's kind of about where he's been. You know, those are generally going to be above the break shots where, I mean, that's not, can make that shot if he's just being given it, but that's not what scares you about his game. And I really thought that the Kings should have gone more to the Fox Sabonis pick and roll than they did, because Kevon Looney in a drop coverage like that, they hurt that in this series. And it just surprised me that they didn't go to that Fox was really invisible through, like, very large swaths of this game. A big part of that, of course, is that he couldn't get out in transition because they couldn't get a rebound, and or they couldn't force a turnover. And that's obviously where Fox and the Kings in general are most dangerous. Same thing with Monk too. But I thought there were times in this series where it seemed like De'Aaron Fox was unstoppable in the half court and was just a major problem schematically for the Warriors. And you just didn't feel that at all in this game.
A lot of attention will be, and I mean, should be, on his point guard counterpart, because Curry had one of the best playoff game sevens we've ever seen. I wanted to give De'Aaron Fox's line just for the second half of this game. 8 points on 2 of 9 from the field, 1 of 4 on twos, 1 of 5 on threes. Did get to the line 4 times, made 3 of those 4. 1 assist, 4 turnovers, 3 fouls, -21.
And I do wish he hadn't suffered that finger injury and that we could have seen him at his absolute best in this game 7, but that was not the case, obviously.
And just as a stray note, because you and I were both in the interview room for Golden State after the game, I thought it was notable and interesting that Draymond Green heaped praise on De'Aaron Fox, said that he was, you know, cut from that cloth, and that when Draymond was reminded of a series years ago against the Clippers where they lost in round 1, game 7, and distinctly mentioned him as the, like, the head of the snake for the players, and praised Mike Brown, of course, as the head of the snake for the coaches. Distinctly did not mention another player that you could argue was the head of the snake for the Kings, but considering their personal animosity, not a huge surprise.
Well, also considering reality, it's not a huge surprise.
Also true.
And particularly in this series, when Sabonis couldn't do anything one-on-one against Looney or Draymond, really. He scored on them maybe 3 or 4 times one-on-one in the whole series. So anything else that really kind of sticks out to you from this? And I have a couple smaller notes, and I also kind of want to just talk about the Kings and this season, put that in perspective a little bit.
There were some good moments from Keegan Murray as a driver. Like, his two-point game is something that I'm excited to see develop over the next couple of years. And I've been of the belief for a long stretch of the year, and I really like the film on Keegan Murray as well, that he is going to be a starter in the league for a long time. He did get lit up by Stephen Curry. Congratulations, you're joining a very large group, many of whom are illustrious. But offensively, I think that his game fits in with a lot of different types of teams, and this Kings team is most certainly among them. And then defensively, I think he does some things right, and I think Murray could be a part, and we saw it at times in the series, be a part, a successful part of a stronger overall defense. Like, I don't think we talk a lot about how power forwards, and Keegan Murray bounces between power and small forward because of his partnership with Harrison Barnes in the starting five, but I really like his game.
Yeah, and we saw there was a time in the third where him getting to the foul line and making shots actually was kind of keeping them in it, and certainly utilizing him as more of a wing scorer is something that I think they're going to need to explore very heavily in the future, to have a few other gears that they can attack with, particularly in the half court. And so that's really encouraging. Obviously, he got targeted defensively, but there's also not a lot of Steph Currys out there. You know, it'd be interested to see in a different playoff series what that would look like for him. The last thing I want to talk about before we kind of hit on this Kings season, the Warriors did, this is something that they broke out in these playoffs. I haven't seen this much around the league, but the math does kind of like it, is this double team in a last shot of the quarter situation. And they definitely, it seemed like they gave up a wide open three out of that every time, but they also did it with 14 seconds left in the quarter. And this time they gave up a wide open three. I think it was to Terrence Davis at the end of the third. They're up 9. Monk flies in, incredible tip rebound, and one, cuts it to 6. And you're like, go out. It's after the Warriors had this insane quarter with 15 offensive rebounds, the Kings were awful. This is maybe a chance for them to strike if the Warriors get tired at the end. And then Klay comes down, gets a beautiful play call from Kerr where they run the pick and roll of Steph, double team. Draymond set the screen, which he didn't do that much of for Steph. And then they've run this over the years many times. Then Draymond sprints out of that, goes and gets Klay off a screen, and Klay hits the 3, gets the and one for a foul, puts him back up 10 going into the 4th. That was one of the biggest plays of the game. And then the Kings don't score at all for basically the first 4 minutes of the 4th, as Steph is I think even during that period, Steph only had 2 field goals himself, and that was it for the Warriors. But that 4-0, 4 minute period at the start of the 4th really just completely took the air out of the building at that point. And
Nate, I'll phrase it differently. The Kings scored once in the first 5.5 minutes of the 4th quarter.
Yeah, and they definitely missed some open threes. They're 2 of 22 on threes in the second half. And guys like Herter, Barnes had a wide open corner 3 during that stretch. There are a lot of guys who would love to have him back. And Mike Brown said it during this series there is a difference. Even Fox said it during his presser that there is a difference between making some of these shots in a playoff setting in a game 7 versus game 5. 50 or game 70 or game 20, I think was his quote. I want to, obviously an amazing season for the Kings. We'll roll through that a little bit. But I think we can go back to, and I think in some ways this is all the more painful because of how good the Kings looked at times in this series, of the Kings' decision to not play their guys on the final Friday of the regular season in a decision that basically ensured that they were going to get the Warriors in this series. Had they won that game, which no guarantee they would have won had they played Fox and Sabonis, but I mean, they would have had a pretty good chance against regular season Warriors without Andrew Wiggins, but they elected not to play their guys. They had to have known that this was the likely result of that. They would have had a decent chance of it being either the Clippers or probably the Lakers would have been who they would have played because the Lakers are the tiebreaker. Now, Lakers played pretty well against Memphis as well. Memphis essentially is a better team than Sacramento, although I'm not sure that this version of Memphis was.
I don't think they were, for the record.
No, I think also just from a matchup standpoint, the Kings would have been much more difficult for the Lakers to deal with. But maybe that's just they're like, hey, we'd rather play the Warriors than the Lakers. That's, it's still the Warriors, right? Like, they won the championship last year. Like, this Lakers team is pretty good, but, like, you know, LeBron is, obviously we'll talk more about that series probably tomorrow, but I think that's also kind of hindsight to say that the Lakers are really good and they were obviously going to beat Memphis. Memphis was favored in that series. So they made that decision. And I mean, I probably wouldn't have wanted to set myself up to play Steph Curry in the first round. And while they had an amazing effort in the series, ultimately they fell short. And maybe part of that was because of that decision. That's one of those ones that we're going to remember for a while, like the Bucks not even trying to get the 2 seed last year, and obviously the Daniel Otoro game, like some of these late seeding quandaries or decisions that end up really making a difference. And this wasn't one where it's like, oh yeah, you should have intentionally lost the game, like the Clippers probably should have against the Suns. But this is one where, like, hey, if you would have competed a little bit harder, that actually would have been the right decision. But I guess they felt like their guys were fatigued and they wanted to rest them or whatever. But what do you think now of the Kings in this season and how you're feeling about them as, like, a possible, like, true contender going forward?
I'm of two minds. I think that the playoffs are clarifying in a way that the regular season is not, and you get to see these players face all sorts of different challenges than they do in the regular season. And the Warriors are a distinct challenge compared to other teams, and the some of the rotations and the guys they have, the unusual strengths and weaknesses. I thought that a lot of Kings did well, and it was interesting. Draymond talked about this after the game, and he meant it in a very different way than I'm about to use it, but like, you lose respect for a lot more players than you gain respect for in the postseason experience. That's often a part of it. And I thought that a lot of those Kings did well. I thought De'Aaron Fox did really well. Malik Monk had a wonderful series overall. Sabonis had some of his best defensive play overall, though I think we'll talk about some of his potential shortcomings. Keegan Murray, I thought, especially for a rookie, had some nice moments. And Mike Brown had an extremely impressive series, helped by having an intense familiarity with the Warriors. But the overall philosophy and the buy-in that he had from his players, that bodes really well. So all those things, like, this is a regular season you can build on. This is a postseason that you can build on for Sacramento, even though they did not advance beyond this round. De'Aaron Fox is 25. I think he's going to have some really bright days ahead of him. There are a couple of challenges if we're going to talk about Sacramento moving from the, like, consistently interesting area, where I think they're already there. Like, I don't think that is a situation where, oh, they lost in the first round, they're the next Utah Jazz or anything like that. No, I think Sacramento can put a charge into teams, and there are plenty of ways that they can get better. However, there is a big margin between feisty and interesting and, like, if we're going to talk about winning a conference, winning a championship. And part of that is best player on the floor. Part of that is counter punches and, like, the overall talent level. And my instinct is, if Domantas Sabonis is your center, you could have a very good regular season offense. You can have some good regular season and postseason defensive moments. He had a far better series defensively than I anticipated. But if we're talking about this rarefied air, winning three or four series in the same postseason, I am skeptical that you could do that. You're going to face a variety of opponents with a variety of different ways that they will attack you. And they're all going to be talented teams because that's why they're there in the first place. So I see Sacramento as a team that will be in the conversation for a while, as long as they can keep this team together. But they're going to run into something that happens all the time. And I think they're at a weaker spot right now than, like, let's say Memphis was last year because of Ja and Jaren and Bane and all that. Like, I like Memphis's top group better than I like Sacramento's. Is when you've already kind of spent the key part of your flexibility, adding players who are good enough to supplant the guys that you already have is very difficult to do. It's internal improvement. It's drafting really well. It's recruiting the right guys to sign. But you're not doing that with max cap space. You're not doing that with a top five pick because you're too good for both of those things. You're too expensive for both those things. So I would love to be wrong, and I think their future is bright, but I think that talking about them as a title team right now, knowing what we know right now, that I think does them a disservice.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, Steve Kerr said he characterized them as a contender. And obviously, if you're the Golden State Warriors and you have a series like this against them, you're going to think, well, hey, we're a contender and we really struggle to beat them, so they're a contender. And I'm not sure whether that's true or not. I'm not sure whether this is a situation where the Kings actually like matched up really well with the Warriors because of the fact that the Warriors will turn it over a fair amount because of their transition game and the Warriors kind of being an older team at this point in time, and obviously the familiarity that Mike Brown has with them. I definitely feel as though Sacramento punched above their weight in this series, but you know, then again, I mean, maybe the Warriors are going to just lose to the Lakers or get swept by the Nuggets or something, and then I'll be like, you know, but this Warriors team actually wasn't that good in the end. I don't think that that's the case. I think that this was just a really great series that Sacramento played, and they obviously had home court, which helped too. But you do, I mean, they have a lot of strengths, but they are like pretty dependent on transition. You know, their half court offense was not good in this series. You'd think they could shoot the ball better though. I mean, that's something they'll really wish that they had been able to do more. And but you know, kind of the Sabonis handoff stuff, like how well can that work? If Sabonis can't score one-on-one, you kind of run out of stuff that you can do in the half court other than Fox and Monk, you know, driving to the basket. Obviously, they also were really healthy this year, but I think they'll, as long as they're healthy, they should continue to be, you know, a high 40s, maybe 50 win type of team. And obviously, you mentioned how young they are. Like a lot of these guys can get better, assuming they can re-sign some of their free agents also, or get some other supplemental pieces. But they still do have a lot of weakness. Like we're talking about their best lineup, and maybe they would have a different best lineup against a team that didn't include Steph Curry. But their best lineups were include like three small guards and a center who doesn't protect the rim. They can be a lot better offensively, I think, and this Warriors defense is a very good defense, but they also just have a lot of flaws. So yeah, it is hard for me to see them as a championship contender, but you know, I just don't really know the answer to like, hey, was this a good matchup for them, or were the Warriors like half court defense actually a pretty good matchup against them and they could have really smoked another team's defense? Like that's something I'm looking forward to finding out, hopefully in future years.
It is kind of remarkable to think about. I mean, when you consider all of the injuries and everything else that happened this year, to theoretically pencil in not only another team that we expect to make the playoffs in the West the next few years, but a young team that could continue to improve. And it's going to be another bloodbath next year in the West.
Yeah, I got two more things actually before we move on to New York and Miami. One is, remember when it was like, oh man, the East is, that's where it's at, man. Like the three best teams in the league might be in the East. Obviously, Milwaukee is out now and they were apparently a bit of a paper tiger. I mean, Jimmy Butler is playing at an all-world level to be sure. But now Embiid has gone down and we'll see whether he's able to play or not. But that's not a new thing. Like that happens to him somewhat regularly, unfortunately. Even Boston, you know, their best player is Jason Tatum, but to me, he's not a top five player in the NBA. Butler is playing at that level, of course. The Knicks don't really have something like that. But, and now you look at the Western Conference, look at this fucking star power in this Final Four. I mean, Jesus Christ. Like, now, I mean, LeBron maybe is a little, that name is maybe a little bit bigger than what he is at this point. But, I mean, the Lakers still have, like, LeBron and AD. That's probably two top 15 players at least. Of course, Steph Curry is playing again. I mean, to be 35 and just put up a playoff game like that is unreal.
Oh, and by the way, Stephen Curry was the best player on the NBA champions last year. And him doing, I mean, this is maybe a little bit extreme, but like him being a great playoff player again is no surprise, should be no surprise to anybody.
No, I mean, he had that type of a regular season when he was healthy too. There's no reason to think. I mean, maybe you felt like, all right, after game six, like he's kind of slowing down. He didn't have like the absolute greatest game in that game six. Like the Warriors haven't scored incredibly well in the series, but like, you know, he still averaged, even after this 50 burger, he averaged 34 points a game in the series. That's pretty good. And then, of course, on the other side, you've got KD. Booker is playing at an all-world level right now. And then Jokic on the other side.
And Jamal Murray.
MVP. Yeah, I mean, Murray isn't quite in that class, like just as an overall star, although perhaps he will be after this playoff run. But I mean, the talent in that Final Four is just insane. You could say, yeah.
Oh, and that, I mean, part of it is just the nature of the West this year. But this, the Warriors winning this, getting to the point where for the first time in NBA history, ESPN Stats and Info had it. Somebody had tweeted to us even earlier in the week about the possibility. One team of all eight seeds made it. So this is not like the four best records in the West or anything. You could argue it's not even the four most talented teams in the West, though they might be the four teams with the most star power, if we're focusing on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing to think that the two-time MVP, who I would have actually voted for him a third time this year, he's not going to get it, it seems like, but that player, the guy who just won two MVPs in a row right before this one, is probably like the fourth biggest star in this Final Four in the West. I mean, that's insane. I can't wait for this round and just the rest of the West playoffs. Any matchup that could occur, as long as, knock on wood, like crazy, these teams stay relatively healthy, any matchup that could occur in the conference finals, just get a monster matchup. In the Dunked On era, where does this rank for you as a first round series? Obviously, it wasn't close at the end, but it was, I mean, just the back and forth was absolutely remarkable for like Kings go up 2-0, Warriors wins three straight, they're going to close it out. Like just the ups and downs of this series were amazing. Warriors became just the seventh team ever to win game five of a tied 2-2 series, lose game six in such a series, and then win the game seven. Such teams were 6-19 in the game seven coming into this one. But I mean, this has got to be right up there, doesn't it?
It does. I'm not as great at remembering these as you. The one that comes to mind was at the very beginning of the Dunked On era, which was that Clippers Spurs series in 15, which was incredible.
Yeah, I think that one was better than this one. I mean, Spurs had just won the championship. CP rips up his hamstring in game seven and then like hits an incredible game winner. Like that game is one of the because neither team made the conference finals that year. That time is one of the game is one of like the all time best game sevens ever. I mean, that and that series as well was like back and forth. There's all sorts of like crazy tactics stuff in that series as well. Like I still remember all the 45 pick and roll and like Greg Popovich going to hack all of that. And there was a lot of star power in that series too. That was a pretty legendary series in terms of first round series. And even though the Bucks won it or lost it in five, and that first round, those last two games of the Bucks Heat series were both just like monster games. Like those are ones that I'm always going to remember.
They were, but the first three games of that series were not as memorable for me.
Denver, Utah in the bubble.
Sure.
That was an amazing series. It's the bubble, so it was a little weird, but I mean, the Denver coming back from 3-1 and Murray and Mitchell dueling with 50 point games and obviously like a classic Game 7 ending in that series as well. Trying to jog my memory if there are any other ones that are.
Well, and Nate, it's the first series that you've ever gone to every game, right?
Yeah, it is actually. And this was only the third Game 7 I've ever been to. The only other two were in 2016, which were both obviously huge classics. Warriors now go to 3-1 in Game 7s in the Kerr era, and they go to 7-2 in elimination games in the Kerr era.
Also, the Warriors still have never lost a Western Conference playoff series with Steve Kerr as their coach.
Okay, couple other like awesome first round series. Clippers Mavs in 21, where the road team won every game of the series until Game 7, and Kawhi had that ridiculous 45-point game guarding Luka in Game 6. The Clippers were down 0-2 and down 30-11 in Game 3 in Dallas at one point in that series.
Oh, while you're two other stats that I had in my notes from other people, from my former writer, Audie Joseph, now of CBS, Kevon Looney averaged 18 rebounds over the last five games of this series. That is completely ludicrous. And per Tim Reynolds, and I quizzed you on that, I'm not going to do that here. This was the eighth time that a player had 41 or more in a road Game 7, and only the second time out of all of those that that player's team won the game. The other one being Calvin Murphy way back in 1981. So those are the only two times that a 40-plus Game 7, road Game 7, has ever produced a winner.
Yeah, so this was quite a trip down memory lane to see these 40-plus point performances in Game 7s. Steph's was the only one that took place in fewer than 41 minutes. KD had the previous high with that 48 in the overtime loss, although all 48 came in regulation.
They did.
I think he was like 0 for 5 in the overtime. Sam Jones at home had 47 against Cincinnati in 1963. Dominique, of course, also had 47. That was the previous high on the road in that classic game that they lost in 1988 at Boston. Luka had 45 in that series had 46 in that series I just referenced, Game 7 in 2021 against the Clippers. Another forgotten performance in an absolute classic game in a loss. Kevin Johnson had 46 in 1995 against Houston, the Mario Elie game. It's one of the only two road 3-1 comebacks. The other, of course, being Cleveland over Golden State in 2016. LeBron had 45 in Game 7 in 2008. 45 of his team's 92 points in that one. Paul Pierce had 41. LeBron also had 45 for Cleveland against Indiana. That was another great first round series, actually, in the Dunked On era, 2018, kind of underrated series. Charles Barkley, I think he had 44 and 22 in Game 7 against Seattle in 1993. And another one there's two other ones that really kind of stick out for me. Jerry West, 42 points in 48 minutes in Game 7 of the 69 finals, which they lost by two at home to Boston, Bill Russell's final year. That was when I think the inaugural NBA Finals MVP, which West won as a loser, so the only player to do that. Tim Duncan had 41 in 2006, a home loss to Dallas in overtime. That was the Manu Ginobili foul on Dirk Nowitzki's drive to let them tie it up after Dallas was blowing a 3-1 lead.
Oh, well, while we're talking about Game 7s of the Dunked On era, this wasn't as prolific from scoring perspective, but one of the most weirdly forgotten game performances because his team lost in a game that everyone remembers, Draymond Green's 32-15-9 in Game 7 of the 16 finals.
Yeah. Well, LeBron played a pretty good Game 7.
He did.
Even though he was only 9-24 from the field. I think that's right. That was off the top of my head. That's terrifying if I actually remember that. Sometimes I just like go back and look at the box score of that game because it was just such a ridiculous game. Okay, that's probably about it. But I would say of all these series that we're talking about here, just to finish that up, Celtics Bucks in 2018 was also a really good one, the last year of the pre-Budenholzer era for the Bucks. And this one wasn't in the Dunked On era, but probably the previous best ever first round that comes to mind for me was 2014, when you had six No, I'm sorry. 5-7-game series. Nets, Raptors, Pacers, Hawks, Clippers, Warriors. That one's so memorable, obviously, for that was the Donald Sterling series. Thunder over the Grizz after being down 3-2 in that series, I believe. Spurs over the Mavs, the number one seed. They ended up winning the championship, got to a game seven. And then another series that wasn't a seven gamer ended with Damian Lillard's walk-off buzzer beater in game six. So I think that second round or that first round is probably better than this one. And this one only had one game seven, but this might be the second most interesting, if not just like the best in terms of the overall gameplay and drama, but probably the second most interesting first round ever with all the upsets.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
All right, now that I've gone down memory lane here, we're allowed to do that. We've been doing this for, this is our ninth playoffs, so I think we're allowed to start doing that at this point. Miami draws first blood against the Knicks. Start off with this. What kind of hewed to your expectations and what surprised you in this game?
I think that one thing that kind of does both in the course over the course of the contest is New York around the basket. And so in that first half, and it's funny, the way that I experienced this game is the first time I experienced it was listening to the game on Knicks radio because I was driving to Sacramento for game seven. And then I, of course, rewatched it. And first of all, radio broadcasting of basketball is ludicrously hard and they do a very good job. But in that first half, the Knicks had 40 points in the paint, 20 of 24 shots. They didn't get to the line a ton in part because they were making attempts and there wasn't as much there. That 40 points went down to 22 in the second half, and that was a huge part of what led to Miami's success and eventually coming back. And I thought like there was this element. It's funny. I was listening to the Knicks feed and they were talking about basically like what they need to do is just play the same way. And I was just, I it was one of those games that I thought if I was watching it live based on the way they'd been describing it, I'm like, oh, this is going to be, Miami's going to have a huge run first. Cause when you play really well and you're only up five and the other team is as talented as the Heat are, that generally doesn't go well for you.
Yeah. And surely the Knicks 7 of 34, 3-point shooting, 12 of 20 from the foul line are things that will stick in Tom Thibodeau's craw for sure. But it's not like the Heat had this unbelievable shooting performance either.
Sure. Especially by their standards.
No, not by their recent standards. And Jimmy Butler didn't have the type of monster game that we thought that he would. And obviously we'll talk about his ankle sprain at the end here. But I think that was one thing that did hew to expectations was that Tom Thibodeau was not going to just let him isolate, let him get off, particularly in pick and roll. They had Mitchell Robinson up to the level of the ball early in the game. They weren't going to let Jimmy turn the corner, get downhill and draw fouls on them. And it's pretty remarkable. Like the Knicks got up a lot of threes. Like Obi Toppin took 11 3-pointers. I mean, that was the other thing that I thought the Heat, you knew what their plan was going to be. We're going to give a lot of help from our guards at the nail. And if you want to get a pass to an Obi Toppin or something for an above the break three or Josh Hart, we are going to gap the fuck off of Josh Hart every single time with our guards. They're willing even to switch Max Strus onto Brunson because then they had, it was usually Jimmy started on Brunson, or if it was Gabe Vincent on him, then that guy would basically just stand at the free throw line while Brunson tried to isolate on Max Strus. But they would do that without actually double teaming. And they're like, all right, you want to throw it to Obi Toppin or throw it to Josh Hart up here? Yeah, go ahead. We'll close out or we just trust our guards to be able to do that. And that's something that the Heat drill relentlessly. And we saw it on that last play of the Bucks series when Budenholzer elected not to call timeout and the Heat just kind of swallowed up some of those openings up top. And they did a pretty good job with that in the second half. In the first half, as you mentioned, they were getting into the paint and scoring more easily than might have been expected. So it got there eventually, but New York was really able to attack the paint more than I would have expected early on.
Two of the prominent players in that paint attack were RJ Barrett and Obi Toppin. You brought up Toppin's 3-point shooting, but I thought he also, even though he only took four shots from 2-point range, I thought that he helped put some of that pressure around the basket. But RJ Barrett, I mean, 9 of 15 on twos, got to the line 8 times, had some really nice passes, including some lobs to to Rob Mitchell Robinson. I thought he played a much better offensive game than I anticipated. And it wasn't just the first half. I mean, he had 13 in the first, 13 in the second. It was very first quarter dominant and then quiet in the second, but then had a pretty solid second half overall.
Yeah, and he's going to have a matchup that he probably thinks he can take advantage of here. He was only 1 of 5 from three, but he's going to have Gabe Vincent on him a lot of the time. If they're going to put Butler on Jalen Brunson, which they did for a reasonable amount, I'll credit you for predicting that was going to happen. I thought they'd kind of hold him back a little bit more. Obviously, Randall didn't play. I don't think we mentioned that yet, but I presume most of you guys know that already. But yeah, Barrett has that size advantage. They run some nice plays to get him into the lane, going to his left hand, and he's not going to just blow by guys necessarily, but he can use his body to get shots off in the lane reasonably well. What about the rebounding battle?
We saw the Knicks dominate on the offensive glass in the first round against the Cavs. And Cleveland, this is something I brought up in the preview, that Cleveland is a much worse defensive rebounding team overall than the Heat are. And I thought that New York did a good job. 31% offensive rebound rate is nothing to sneeze at. And they were extremely inefficient at converting those. They had a 57 offensive rating off of those second chance opportunities. That's not great. But for me, the most indelible part of the rebounding battle was actually what followed some of the Heat defensive rebounds in that third quarter, and that was the triumphant return of the Kevin Love outlet pass.
Yeah, Love only played 16 minutes in the end, but yeah, he had 3 assists in a row, and one of them might have been for a foul, but he just gunning these outlet passes, 75 feet, Butler leaking out, and obviously you got to get a defensive rebound to do that, which he's pretty good at, and he's 2 of 5 from 3, again, only 60 minutes, but still, his skills are diminished, but it does feel like the Heat are maximizing the skills that he does have more than we've seen really since he was in Minnesota. Like, there was a lot of the Heat or the Cavs when LeBron was there, like, you're not going to run a lot of motion stuff and off ball stuff, like that LeBron's going to just dominate the ball and he'll just kill the other team. And Love was mostly asked to space out or post up against mismatches. They didn't use his passing a ton or like his movement shooting a ton necessarily, but even at this age, I think he's 34 now, like, he does have these skills. And obviously the Cavs taking him out of the rotation, it was premature, especially because he had that thumb issue. Yeah, and Butler, again, just for him to get like 3 looks, either baskets or fouls off of just leak outs in the third quarter, like, that's another thing that's got to just like roil Tom Thibodeau's stomach. And Butler also had 4 offensive rebounds, had like another bucket where they tried to front him in the post and they just lobbed it over to him as well. That was when the Heat went with Love at center late in the first quarter. So even though Butler didn't have like this dominating individual creation game, he's going to score because he just has these ways of beating you that aren't just, okay, we're locked in, like, give him the ball, like, how are we going to deal with this? It's like, he's always finding some way to beat you. Like, he never stops, and it's pretty impressive. Couple other things that I thought were pretty interesting. They tried to post up Jimmy on Josh Hart, and Hart actually got 2 stops on him, like, didn't really get moved. So that's interesting. Hart was the main matchup, ended up playing 43 minutes, as did Butler in this game.
Yeah, Quentin Grimes, who actually guarded Butler a lot in the regular season games, only played 10 minutes coming back from his contused shoulder.
The Knicks tried to kind of hide Jalen Brunson on Max Strus a fair amount of the time. He didn't spend a ton of time going after Brunson. That's something that they might look at some point in this series, as JB Bickerstaff did as well. When Miami went with Love at center, which they didn't do too much, I thought that the Knicks kind of blew it by putting Mitchell Robinson on Love rather than trying to put him on Caleb Martin instead and trying to switch some of those Love actions. Manuel Quickley still just not really having much of an impact in these playoffs. 3 of 9 from the field for 9 points. Kyle Lowry came through big at the end, particularly once Jimmy Butler sprained his ankle. He got a couple of buckets in pick and roll as Butler was just like hanging out in the corner. 18 points for Lowry, and they closed it out with Vincent and Lowry together, a very small but stout defensive backcourt. I also thought that in the fourth quarter in particular, you just felt Miami's
overall intelligence and experience edge of just the number of just kind of grifty bullshit fouls that are still fouls that guys like Butler and Lowry were able to draw. And I thought that Jalen Brunson, for his part, was kind of trying to draw fouls like that, but the Heat weren't going for it. Brunson only got to the line for 4 free throws. And I thought on a lot of his plays in the second half, Brunson was like, try to draw the foul first. You know, he'd drive, then he'd try to like extend his arms out and go through somebody's arms, and then the Heat wouldn't go for it. And then when you bring the ball up like that, you make actually making the shot much more difficult if you don't actually get the call. And I thought Brunson was just call hunting a little more than he should have been to just try to make the shot. And obviously he was miserable for 3 at 0-for-7 and 5 turnovers, which is very uncharacteristic of him to have that many turnovers.
I'm happy you brought up Lowry. He also had a couple of big defensive plays, blocks and steals. Over the course of this game, had a steal late that pretty much solidified the outcome for Miami. And Caleb Martin also had an amazing block too. He just kind of flew out of nowhere. I'm trying to remember who he got on that play, but it was fantastic. He had a couple of nice moments. And then at times during these playoffs, Spoelstra, particularly after the Tyler Hero injury, has had to lean more on guys that we didn't necessarily expect. And like Duncan Robinson did exactly what you need. He took a bunch of threes in 13 minutes. He just didn't make any of those. So I expect to see that swing a little bit. And then Martin played 31 minutes, and I thought he did a good job.
Let's see. What else did I have?
What'd you think of Bam? We haven't really talked about him much.
Yeah, I thought he was much better in the second half, and he gave them enough from that kind of upper paint area against Robinson, who, as tough of a matchup as Robinson could be, he still isn't as good as Brook Lopez is at kind of some of those surprise high standing reach contests. So I think Bam probably found the going a little bit easier. It wasn't, they didn't run a ton through him or anything like that. I thought defensively in the second half in particular, he looked really good. There was one possession where RJ Barrett, I think, was going up against Vincent and was trying to get all the way to the rim. And it was basically kind of like a 2-on-2 on the left side of the floor. Barrett is getting near the elbow area, wants to turn the corner on Vincent, but Bam is kind of showing just enough to deter Barrett. And then the moment Barrett picked up his dribble to shoot the ball from mid-range, Bam just sprints back to Mitchell Robinson, checks him out, and they ended up forcing a miss and getting the defensive rebound. So he did one of his better jobs, I thought, as just more of a conventional help defender in this game. And maybe part of why they gave up so many paint points in the first was because he was a little bit worried about boxing out Mitchell Robinson. And Robinson did have 5 offensive boards, but that ended up being manageable for Miami. New York only had 12 and Miami had 10. So there was a relative draw in that category. And then the Heat also just only turning it over 8 times. So they really ended up pretty much winning the possession battle, and they really won the free throw battle as well, getting 11 more points from the line. So Miami, even though the Knicks were so much better from 2 in this game than Miami was, Miami basically won every other category.
Yeah, and I mean, we'll see how that continues moving forward. For me, I think the next thing we have to talk about is where things go for Jimmy Butler. Jeff Stotts tweeted a little bit about this, that Butler has had a history of right ankle sprains, and there are 6 different occasions where Butler has sprained his right ankle and didn't miss any time at all. This one seemed worse than definitely, so I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of Jimmy Butler's ankle sprains. But notably, Butler has never missed more than 3 consecutive games. And there are always 2 parts of this. One is how much time are you out? But then the second part is how long is it until you're right? And winning this game means I think Miami's going to be definitely more judicious with him in game 2 and potentially in game 3 as well.
Ankle sprains are really unpredictable. That's what Spo said after the game. Butler did stay in. He had gotten fouled. If you haven't seen the play, he's driving right. Josh Hart flops, he's like kind of on the side of him, and Butler lowered his shoulder. Like Hart wasn't really even in front of him, but Hart goes down and he gets his leg tangled up with Butler. Butler turned it real bad and he was down for a long time. Like this one definitely looked, it was an odd type of sprain because he didn't as much land on Hart as Hart kind of just like kicked him from behind as he was falling down. And so it seemed like the mechanism was a little bit different. And obviously, the initial pain level like that that can be an indicator, but not a dispositive one. How well he was able to move after it. I mean, he did take the two free throws. He stayed in. He finished the game. Afterwards, Spo was asked, like, would you let anyone else stay in the game after that kind of injury? And Spo said, I don't know. Udonis Haslem, probably. I don't want to get beat up on national TV. So, but Butler couldn't move at all. I thought the Knicks really failed in not going after him on the defensive end because he couldn't move. He just stood in the corner the entire time. There was one time where the Heat missed a shot, a loose ball rebound came towards him, and he was only able to take like two steps. So like he couldn't move at all.
At all.
And yeah, and normally you might see guys kind of be able to stay in the game and then it'll really swell up on him afterwards, but they can kind of at least move some. He wasn't even able to do that. Like he should not have stayed in the game. Like it would be, and if it hadn't been like right at the end, it wouldn't have lasted because the Knicks would have figured out that he was too much of a liability. Instead, the Knicks had one field goal in the last 5 minutes of the game and turned it over three times and had three shots blocked. So Miami's defense was great at the end, and their the process by the Knicks not so good when you consider how injured Butler was. But yeah, I would be beyond shocked if he plays in game two. Then they have a 3-day break until game three.
It is Tuesday, Saturday. Yeah.
So that'll be big, but I mean, this looked like a pretty bad, in terms of grades, it's hard to say. Again, you just like, you can judge, all right, what kind of an angle was his foot at and how much weight did he put on it? And, you know, how long was it in that position before it snapped back? It's impossible to really know. And Butler is really tough. Like, I'm sure we will see him again in this series. It would not totally shock me if that's not until game four, though. And obviously it wouldn't be until game four, I think, if you didn't have this 3-day break. But what a bummer, because again, I mean, he wasn't as incandescent in this game, but obviously was the best player on the floor. I mean, he had one of the best playoff series ever in that first run. So I mean, the East playoffs just continues to get ravaged by injuries, and let's hope that he can make it back and be close to himself. I think they could still win this series getting, you know, 75% of Jimmy Butler for five of the next six games. I think that's possible. But winning this game was imperative and huge blown opportunity for the Knicks. Like, you think surely the Knicks will just win game two, but they should be up 2-0 or 1-0 and headed towards 2-0, you think, right now. But that said, when everyone was healthy and available, I felt like this series was, or this game, largely hewed to what I thought would be the case, where the Heat were just more veteran. Butler was the best player on the floor. Bo, a little bit better coaching. And you just kind of, and the Knicks really struggling to score in the half court. So there's also the return potentially of Randall, though. And you have to think they'll bring him back regardless. But I wonder how many minutes he'll play. Do they bring him off the bench? There's also the 3-day break for him too. So yeah, I'm very interested to see what their strategy is there. They, like I said, this is a pretty good matchup for him when healthy, particularly if Butler is going to be out. I mean, they really have no one guard him. So unless it's going to be Bam, everyone else, he should be able to just power through, you would think. But yeah, be interesting game two for sure. Our next playback, by the way, is going to be tomorrow. We'll do the end of Sixers Celtics if it's close, but then of course the main event is going to be a huge game two in Denver and Phoenix. Thanks so much for being subscribers, and if you are not a subscriber, this West second round is going to be awesome. Get in, you can get our analysis of every game. We're going to start doing our free agent rankings, and then obviously all 30 off seasons. A lot of pretty damn interesting off seasons coming up here, Danny, particularly with the disappointments that we've already had in the first round for some teams, and then even more disappointments to come for teams that have very, very high expectations. So if you're listening on the public feed, please consider subscribing. Never a better time. We'll talk to you all soon.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.